Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Dalia Mogahed, Senior Analyst and Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies in Washington, D.C., and co-author of Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. Ms. Mogahed's appearance was sponsored by the United States Center for Citizen Diplomacy in partnership with the Gallup Organization and the World Affairs Council of America. It took place at the Amundsen Law Center on the campus of Creighton University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, May 28, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Citizen Diplomacy, the Gallup Organization, the World Affairs Council, Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Piotr Juskiewicz, Associate Publisher with Gallup Press.
It is with great pleasure that I introduce Dalia Mogahed. Dalia is a Senior Analyst and Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, which is dedicated to providing data-driven analysis of the views of Muslim populations around the world. She's co-author of the book Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think, which has received critical acclaim from various global thought leaders. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA, called Who Speaks for Islam a book Americans must read before time runs out. Archbishop Desmond Tutu said few books could be more timely. Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor and former advisor to Paul Bremer in Iraq, called it required reading. Dalia's analysis has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Policy Magazine, the Harvard International Review, and other academic and popular journals. Her audiences have included the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations, the World Economic Forum, the Brookings Institution's U.S. Islamic World Forum, and she has discussed Gallup findings with a wide range of opinion leaders, including Tony Blair, Madeleine Albright, Newt Gingrich, Chuck Hagel, Jeffrey Sachs, Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, Queen Rania of Jordan, and others. Dalia is a member of Women in International Security, and she serves on the Project on U.S. Engagement with the Global Muslim Community, as well as on the Brookings Crisis in the Middle East Task Force. Dalia has an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering. Her master's degree in business administration is from the Graduate School of Business at the University of Pittsburgh. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Dalia Mogahed.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for taking the time and sacrificing your personal time to be with us today. I want to talk to you today about a very important topic. Before I do, I want to tell you a little bit about the mission that started the company that I represent, the Gallup Organization. Of course, as you know, Gallup's operational headquarters are only a few blocks away right here in Omaha. Gallup was founded by a man named George Gallup, whose core mission was to help people be heard. He said, if democracy is about the will of the people, that someone should go find out what that will is. He thought that leaders made better decisions when they knew the will of the people. And it was this simple premise that was the foundation on which Dr. Gallup built his organization, the Gallup Organization. Almost 70 years ago, and he was one of the first who developed a methodology to reap the wisdom of the people as a natural resource for the public good. We wrote this book to share what we've learned by listening to the voices of a billion Muslims, a community that has often been discussed but seldom heard, because we believe that today, three quarters of a century later, Dr. Gallup's mission has never been more important. Our country was attacked on 9/11/2001 in a way that few could imagine or even believe. Shortly after, Osama bin Laden released a statement laced with religious rhetoric, praising the attacks. Since then, violence has grown exponentially as Muslims and non-Muslims alike continue to be victims of global terrorism. Terrorism has occurred in Morocco to Indonesia, from Madrid to London, and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq rage on. Is this evidence of an all-out clash between Muslims and the West? The vital missing piece among the many voices weighing in on this question, and there are certainly many, is the actual views of ordinary Muslims. With all that is at stake for the United States and Muslim societies, indeed for the entire world, the time has urgently come to democratize the debate. So who speaks for Islam, what a billion Muslims really think, is about this silenced majority. This book is the product of a mammoth multi-year Gallup research study. Between 2001 and 2007, Gallup conducted tens of thousands of hour-long face-to-face interviews with residents of more than 35 nations that are predominantly Muslim or have substantial Muslim populations. What you see here is a map of Tanzania, a developing nation with a poor infrastructure. In spite of extreme challenges conducting research in even the most difficult terrain, Gallup insists on getting as close to a random sample as possible, since our chief research officer often reminds us that only God can truly create a completely random sample. However, we do try to come as close as we humanly can. The red dots are called what are primary sampling units. They are actual locations of households we interviewed. As you can see, we don't just stick to easy-to-get-to urban centers or places that have well-developed roads. Our samples represent residents, young and old, educated and illiterate, men and women, and from urban and rural backgrounds. So one of the commitments that we at Gallup have is it is an extraordinarily strong dedication to rigorous methodology. And that same methodology, whether it's in the United States or Tanzania, must apply. There are polls, for example, and when they're released, you realize that they only went to a few urban centers and called it a nationwide poll. That's a little like asking only people in New York City and LA and calling that a representative sample of the United States. With the random sampling method that Gallup used, results are statistically valid within a plus or minus 3-point error. In English, that means our results are only 3% away had we asked every adult in the country. This is what a random sample actually gives you. In totality, we surveyed a sample representing more than 90% of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims, making this the largest, most comprehensive study of Muslim opinion ever done. This study is, in fact, just a small part of a much wider endeavor, the Gallup World Poll, where Gallup is giving a voice to the entire globe on issues of health, education, citizenship, and leadership. This colossal study is paid for entirely by Gallup. Gallup, as a for-profit commercial company, emphatically protects this independence by never accepting funding from any organization to do its polling. All our survey research, including, of course, the World Poll, is self-funded and therefore totally independent. We are therefore beholden to no one. As you can imagine, the only way to be sustainable is to create a business model around this endeavor. So we have subscribers to our full data set, similar to any other commercial research company. But because this information is so important, we published a book about the contemporary Muslim world based on our research as our contribution to the world. With the vast amounts of data that we collected, we started to mine that data and ask the tough questions that are being debated today. What motivates sympathy for terrorism? Is democracy compatible with Islam? What do women want? I think that's a question a lot of people are wondering. I'm not sure if I'll be able to completely answer it today. And then we allowed the data, not vocal extremists, experts, pundits, or politicians, to answer those questions. And let that data draw our picture. The product is the book, Who Speaks for Islam? Our data revealed far more than we could possibly cover in one book. But we wanted to include some of the most important insights. We uncovered a number of findings, but the most important was this. The conflict between Muslim and Western communities is far from inevitable. It is more about perceptions of policies than a clash of principles. However, until and unless decision makers listen directly to the people and gain an accurate understanding of this conflict, extremists on all sides will continue to gain ground. Today, I will touch upon some of the most important findings regarding Muslim-Western relations, and then I look forward to your questions. Now, one thing that's been discussed quite a bit is the idea of whether or not values around freedom and democracy are compatible. Is there a fundamental clash in values around democracy between Muslims and the West? So we looked at our research. When we asked an open-ended question to our respondents in majority Muslim countries, we simply asked them, what do you admire most about the West? And here's what we found. When we posed this question to Muslims around the world, a trend, the most frequent response was technology. The most admired thing about the West was technology. The second most admired was liberty and democracy. When we asked that same question of Americans, we got the same two responses, the same two top responses. And remember, this is an open-ended question, not a multiple-choice exam where an infinite number of possibilities are available to people. Just to give you a flavor of what people said in their own words, a Saudi Arabian respondent said, freedom of the press and opinion, an expression, also scientific advancement, was what they admired most about the West. In Iran, social justice and having access to nuclear power, real democracy. In Pakistan, they said law is above all and everyone observes the law, and also their political system is transparent and they are following democracy in its true sense. Moroccan told us it was liberty and freedom and being open-minded with each other. We also asked a question about a constitution. If people were given the opportunity to draft their own constitution for a new country, what basic guarantees would they include? And so we asked about freedom of speech, and we defined it for people in case they didn't understand what it meant. We said it meant being able to say whatever you wanted about the political, social, and economic issues of the day. We found that strong majorities around the world said that they would include freedom of speech as a fundamental right in this theoretical constitution. You can see that Egyptians, 94%, similar to Americans at 97%, all the percentages are strong majorities. We also asked people their dreams for the future. What we didn't hear, what people didn't say is, they didn't say their dream was to wage jihad, but instead we heard about getting a better job, better economic well-being and prosperity, and offering a better future for their children. We heard this from 70% of Indonesians and 54% of Iranians, for example. But Muslims wish to achieve this progress within their own religion and culture and either be preached to by the West or forced to adopt Western culture. So while admiring much about the West, they wish to achieve progress through their own culture and in their own way. Despite admiring much about the West, few said adopting Western values would help Muslims progress. Instead, among the statements most frequently associated with the Muslim world was attachment to spiritual and moral values would help people progress. However, this attachment should not be mistaken for a desire to be isolated from the West. In fact, eager to have better relations with the West was also among the statements most frequently associated with the Muslim world. In fact, residents of Muslim countries and Americans agree that greater interaction between Muslims and Western communities is more a benefit than a threat, which really underscores why the work that Anne is doing and the Asia Foundation is doing is so important. However, Muslims actually do not see the West, quote unquote, as monolithic. Their perception of different nations falls along policy, not cultural or religious lines. For example, while the United States and the United Kingdom are viewed negatively, views of France and Germany are neutral to positive. In fact, they are viewed as positively as are other Muslim-majority countries. For example, 74% of Egyptians have unfavorable views of the United States, and 69% say the same thing about Britain. However, only 21% express this view of France, while 30% express this view of Pakistan. This issue becomes especially clear when we compare the United States to our neighbor to the north, Canada, which has been called, not by me, but by others, America without the foreign policy. Not sure how Canadians feel about that. For example, while 67% of Kuwaitis have unfavorable views of the United States, this percentage for Canada is 3%. What is perhaps most telling is when respondents are asked to associate different descriptors with different countries. And when you look at a weighted average across the entire database, we found that 70% of our respondents give the United States a descriptor of ruthless, while only 8% and 6% say the same about France and Germany. For many Muslims, the ruthless label is likely reflected in attitudes about the UK and US-led invasion of Iraq, which vast majorities say did more harm than good. Muslims clearly see the conflict as not with Western civilization as a whole, but instead with specific Western powers based on the negative perception of their policies, not their principles. Many Muslims around the world, while admiring Western values, believe that some Western powers do not live these values in their treatment of Muslims. For example, significant percentages of Muslims around the world do not believe the U.S. is serious about democracy in their region. This is the view especially in countries where democratic promotion has been the loudest, such as Egypt and Pakistan. What Muslims say they admire most about the West, they in fact associate most strongly, specifically with the United States. That is, citizen liberties. Yet at the same time, they believe the U.S. is denying Muslims these same rights of self-determination. Doubting American intentions with regard to democracy are closely tied with the perception that America is a hegemonic neo-colonial power that controls the region. More than 65% of Egyptians, Jordanians, and Iranians believe that the U.S. will not allow people in their region to fashion their own political future as they see fit without direct U.S. influence. To explain the deep gap between America's espoused values of democracy, human rights, and self-determination, on one hand, and its perceived treatment of Muslims on the other, Muslims turn to the belief that America and its allies must simply be hostile toward Islam and regard Muslims as inferior. The idea being that since the perceived way Muslims are treated is so antithetical to the admired Western values, these same Western powers must simply be singling Muslims out. So, not surprisingly, when we ask Muslims to tell us what the West can do to improve relations with the Muslim world, the most frequent response, whether we're asking people in Turkey or Saudi Arabia, Morocco or Indonesia, is for the West to demonstrate more respect and to regard Muslims as equals and not inferior. This is a respondent in Lebanon that just gives you an example of what we hear all around the world. The West should treat Muslims equally to improve their relations because they look down upon us. We asked a very direct question: do you believe the Western world respects the Muslim world? And found, probably not very surprising, large percentages of people, especially Palestinians, Egyptians, even Turks, Saudi Arabians, saying no, they did not think the Western world respected the Muslim world. What was somewhat of a surprise, though, was that the majority of Americans agreed. In fact, anti-Muslim sentiment is unfortunately widespread in the U.S. For example, Gallup asked this question, thinking very honestly about your feelings: how much prejudice, if any, do you feel toward the following religious groups? And here's what we heard when we asked about Jews. 74% claimed they had no prejudice, while the remainder said they had at least some prejudice, which shows us that anti-Semitism is unfortunately not yet a relic of the past. When we ask the same question about Muslims, only 34% said no prejudice, while the majority said at least some prejudice. An alarming 19%, nearly one out of five, admitted to having a great deal of prejudice. In 2006, 26% of Americans said they had favorable views of Muslims, compared to 30% who said they had negative views, a net of a negative 4%. And among the most negatively viewed religious groups in the United States, only topping atheists and Scientologists. Now, that was in 2006, where the net was negative 4. We asked the same question in 2008, March, to be exact. And if we look at what has happened between 2006 and 2008, there has not been another terrorist attack, and the violence in Iraq has actually improved, decreased because of the surge. So we might expect things to have gotten a bit better. But unfortunately, what we found is that in March of 2008, the net was a negative 17, where 17% of Americans said they had favorable views of Muslims, and 34 said they had unfavorable. Still, the average American cannot be blamed for these misperceptions. Media content analysis conducted by a firm in Germany called Media Tenor found that the majority, in many cases, of coverage on Islam is sharply negative in U.S. news media. Americans are bombarded every day with news stories about Muslims and majority Muslim countries in which vocal extremists, not evidence, drive perceptions. If you notice here, the time is frame is actually almost exactly between our two measurements, between the end, the last quarter of 2006, and March of 2008. Media Tenor also found that Islam was the most reported on, the most frequently reported on religion in U.S. news media. At the same time, that's what you see in the blue bars. That's the volume of reporting. On the other side is the quality of reporting. Red is negative, yellow is neutral, and green is positive. So if you look at volume times quality, it's clear, it's very easy to see where the negative perception will come from. Media Tenor also found that if we ask the news media who speaks for Islam, 53% of the time would be militants. So the analyst writes, reporting about religious protagonists was rather unbalanced in U.S. news media. While Muslims were frequently associated with militant groups, 53% of the time, 68% of descriptions of Christianity referred to religious organizations or clerics. Now, the issue of militancy, at the heart of the issue of, or the negative perception of Islam, is the issue and the question of violence. And does Islam promote violence? Do Muslims, are they predisposed to supporting violence? So we asked this question. There was a press conference shortly after 9/11, and Donald Rumsfeld was asked, how does the Arab street feel about the attacks? His response was, I don't know. It's not like you can take a Gallup poll. So we did. And here's what we found out. We identified one group, 7% of the global Muslim community, the 90% of it that we talked to, who looked distinctly different from the rest. They thought 9/11 was completely justified and had unfavorable opinions of the United States. The reason we broke out this group is because of how dramatically different they looked on other questions. They were far more likely to say sacrificing one's life for a cause one believes in is justified, and far more likely than fours, threes, twos, and ones to say that attacks on civilians in general were justified. And so we broke them out because they clustered out in the data analysis. We wanted to compare them with the residual group. And so the first comparison, first thing we looked at was religiosity. And our first finding was the lack of a finding. We found no difference between this 7% and the rest in terms of religion being an important part of their daily life. There was no distinguishing power to religiosity discriminating between the two groups. In a number of countries, we asked a follow-up question after we asked people about 9/11, where we simply asked, why do you say that, after the respondent told us their opinion of 9/11? So if they said it wasn't justified, we said, why do you say that? And if they said it was, we said the same thing, why do you say that? Here's what we heard from the mainstream. They talked about the moral objection to terrorism, that it was the loss of human life, that innocent people who had not committed a crime had been killed, not surprisingly. And some referred to their religious beliefs to talk about that moral objection, saying that God hated murder, sometimes quoting from the Quran verses that talk about the prohibition of killing innocent civilians. What was interesting was that the 7% who said it was completely justified, not a single one of those respondents gave religious justifications. Not one referred to verses from the Quran to justify their position. Instead, they used very secular political justifications, such as America is an imperialist power trying to control the world, accusing America of killing civilians, that this is what they deserve. We also looked at the much broader question of attacks on civilians. Are attacks deliberately or targeting civilians, how justified are they? And we asked the American public, and we asked Muslim publics around the world, in many other countries, but I chose the countries that are most associated with militancy in the media, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Lebanon, and found that the American public and Muslim publics around the world were as likely to denounce attacks on civilians as justified. Our studies show that 6% of Americans think the attacks on civilians are completely justified. So that's the group that we identified before in 9/11, the completely justified group. In Saudi Arabia, this figure is 4%. In Lebanon and Iran, it's 2%, which, as you would remember from the beginning, is within our margin of error. In the end, though, the current conflict between the West and the Muslim communities is not inevitable. It is about policy, not a clash about religion or principles. Polls have found that the Lebanese Christian and Muslim hold each other in high regard. More than 90% have favorable opinions of each other. Despite a decades-long civil war in Lebanon, fought roughly along confessional lines. Today, less than a generation after the civil rights struggle, a majority of blacks and whites in America say relations between their groups are good. Where in 1958, only 4% of Americans approved of marriage between blacks and whites, today that number is 80%. These hopeful examples underscore the possibility of improving relations between groups, even those with conflicts lasting centuries, and the relative speed by which this is possible. rather than allow extremists on either side to dictate how we discuss Muslims and the West, we need to instead listen carefully to the voices of ordinary people and thus let facts, not fear, shape our global engagement. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jessica Rowe. I'm a consultant with the U.S. Center for Citizen Diplomacy, and I'm going to moderate the question and answer. And before we invite the audience to pose questions to Ms. Mogahed, which you will do so at the microphone, we have, through Creighton University and the Asian World Center, invited three distinguished individuals who have been prepared questions to pose first to Dalia. And I will introduce them to you and then ask them to speak.
Okay.
Now first, it is Athman Athwadi,
yes,
who is the president of the Creighton School or Saudi Student Association.
Yes.
Next is Dr. Nasser Al-Sharif, who's an associate professor of pharmacy sciences. Then there's Professor Michael Kelly from the Law School of Creighton. And welcome, and perhaps we can begin with you.
Sure. Following Maurong's admonition, we're supposed to keep this very short, and I will. My question to you, Dalia, is I'm sure you saw the poll that was released in the New York Times on Sunday about the Arab media that was conducted by the Kamal Adams Center at the American University of Cairo, and they surveyed 601 journalists in 13 Arab countries. And there were two striking findings, I thought, and I'm just kind of wondering if this tracks your broader findings. Your poll was of the entire Muslim world. Theirs was just a slice of that, the Arab world, and really only a slice of the Arab population, the journalists, which are sort of elites. And I'm sure yours went far deeper than that. But two of the things they found was, with respect to attitudes towards the United States, there was an 89% unfavorable rating toward U.S. policy, but only a 38% unfavorable rating toward the American people. So there was a clear disconnect between Americans and American policy, at least with Arab journalists in the media. And then with respect to America in the Middle East, there was an 83% negative rating for the U.S. role in the Middle East, but only a 46% negative rating for U.S. interference in the region if it leads to benefits. So there was a distinct pragmatism that came out in that poll as well. And granted, this is only Arab journalists and only Arabs within the Muslim world, but does that track your broader findings, or does that dissipate as you move further away from the Arab world into the other parts of the Islamic world?
Thank you, Professor Kelly, for that question. I would say that that trend definitely tracks in terms of the first thing, which is the distinction people make between the U.S. policy and U.S. people. And I'll just tell you a quick story that I always think is fascinating. There was a survey, again, not of everybody, but of young people coming to the United States for an exchange program. And so this was the survey they did before the young people had come to the U.S. It was about 1,000 high school students that were brought over through a State Department program. And they were, and so the survey showed that 90% of them thought Americans were friendly. 90% thought Americans were friendly. And the vast majority had never met an American. I was really perplexed by that, because when you look at our data on the American government, you've got 90% saying it's ruthless, or in some places, or it's not trustworthy, it's aggressive, only 7% saying it's friendly. So yeah, you've got these dramatically different perceptions of the American people on one hand, the American government on the other, and yet people haven't met a single American. So where are they getting this idea from? And I was talking to a young woman in Egypt last summer, and I asked her this, where are people getting this idea? You know, why aren't they conflating, you might expect, conflating the American people and the American government? And she said, friends. I said, what? She said, the show Friends. But it really is true. Even though Hollywood is often accused of doing a lot of negative, it has succeeded in humanizing the American people. And so that is something we see in our data, where there is a big difference between the American policy and the American people. The second piece is a negative role, but 46% vast majority saying that America plays a negative role, but it would be positive if it leads to benefit. And we do find that in that when we ask people, what can the U.S. do to improve relations, or what can the West, we've asked that the West, we've asked that the U.S., and have seen that they're very similar. And basically, we get two kinds of answers. We get the people who say, just leave us alone, and that's all you can do. And then there are people who are slightly more pragmatic who say, actually, we'd like you to maybe transfer some technology. We'd like you to help us with learning more about business expertise, capacity building. Nobody asks for more aid. I mean, absolutely no one asks for aid in general, let alone more aid. They really are very interested in being having capacity building and being helped to help themselves, essentially. So when there's a benefit, then many people are very glad to accept American help. But as of now, the idea or the perception is that it's not very beneficial. But if it were, then some people, many people, would be very happy to receive that help.
Professor Kelly?
No, next.
Thank you. I just want to commend the work that was done and commend also Gallup for taking such a great task. I think for us Muslims and Arabs that have lived in this country, this is a work that validates a lot of what we went through. I do recall as a young pharmacy student going to a presentation by the State Department representative to the Middle East, and that was in 1983, and I asked a question, is there going to be a time when our country, well, at that time I wasn't an American citizen, that this country will associate itself with the aspiration of the people of that part of the world rather than corrupt leaders in that part of the world? And that was in 1982, and I wasn't even that savvy about politics and so on. And I asked that question, and I didn't even know about the doctrine, the Bush doctrine and democracy and all that stuff that we hear now. So this concept really is in the minds of people in that part of the world, not from this survey. It's been around for a long, long time. For me, being here and kind of getting more involved in activism and so on, looking at the Omaha World Herald and covering the Arab Muslim world, and for a year and a half trying to publish in the Public Pulse or editorials and so on, looking at the international page and looking at the images from the Arab world, just the coverage in terms of the headlines being all negative, being all violent, the pictures of kids with guns and so on, which is completely different than what I'm used to, my great-grandparents, grandparents, and so on, that lived in that part of the world and how they live. And I always compare them to the Huxtables and the Waltons of this country, but sadly enough, they're not represented in the media as such, so, which is very sad, very unfortunate. And certainly as a faculty member traveling from 1995 to up to last year and presenting at institutions from Kuwait to Jordan to Egypt to Palestine, I don't recall one single ordinary, and I love that concept, ordinary people in that part of the world saying anything negative about this country. On the contrary, a lot of the sentiments in terms of the questions were the sentiments that I heard from professionals to ordinary people in Jerusalem talking about how hard their life is, but still acknowledging that America can improve their life and America is the one that can help them, you know, in the occupation or whatever. So I don't recall anything in terms of people saying we hate America or we hate their way of life. On the contrary, they appreciate and admire our way of life and, yes, the liberty and so on, what we have in this country. So it's a validation, really, for what I went through in this country. And I would say in terms of 2001, I always had my statistical analysis as a scientist. The largest I heard in terms of the camps in Afghanistan is about 10,000, 15,000 of bin Laden followers. Multiply that by 10 or 15, that's 1.5 million. That's about 0.1% of the 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. So we all try to struggle with how can we explain that part of the world in terms of the ordinary people and our ways living in this country. So I really do appreciate this work in terms of, especially, you know, with the association with Gallup, and hopefully it will make a difference. I guess my question is relating to the future. We do have an election in this country. I don't know what extent, you know, the Bush administration will be impacted by such kind of work with kind of the message that we got for the last 8 years. What is the hope with this kind of work with an Obama, a Clinton, or a McCain, and what kind of work is being done to educate people that are coming, especially in this country? I don't want to talk about Europe, but, you know, is there? Can you give us some idea in terms of how can these be used, this kind of work, to help the future in terms of the tours and who is going to be the leader of this particular country? Thank you.
We're doing a number of things, as Anne mentioned, as a part of our Muslim West Facts initiative, to get this information out to leaders in because of the belief that Dr. Gallup had that the wisdom of the people is something that helps leaders make better decisions. And so we've sent a copy of our book to every member of Congress, and we've briefed talked to, engaged, and met with several leaders in Washington and outside of Washington. And we are working to meet with each of the campaigns.
Thank you.
Hi. I have a question. I'm as a Muslim from Saudi Arabia, I came to this country 2 years ago, and I came prior to 9/11 as well. I was here in 95 and in 99. This book meticulously breaks all the stereotype of Muslims. When I read the book, I always write a note, and I flip to the second page or the second chapter. I have my note been answered or my question been answered. Really, this book helped me understand my Muslim brother as well. I was surprised sometimes, and I was happy most of the times. A Muslim usually here being presented in the media most of the time is like an angry mob marching in the street and burning the flags, which is really happening in the reality. The fact that Muslims like technology and like want to be under the democratic government as well, this is makes the saying that they hate our life or they hate our way of lives as credible as mission accomplished. So it's only media talk. I mean, all media talk. It's not something that really on the ground. I have, my question is, most of the positive sign from signs of, from Muslim population, they like democracy, and they want to be, they want to have technology, and they admire a lot about the West. Those people, the same people, they are not as powerful as the American citizen. So American citizens, they have access to power. They can change. The rest of the world, especially Muslim and Arab, they don't have as power as the Americans because they are under undemocratic government, most of them. So what's the hope message and what's the situation? Because here we see people are hopeful but are powerless. That's in the Muslim world. And here we have people less hopeful and more powerful. So how we balance things out, how we progress from here on out. And thank you.
Well, I think you ask a very good and important question. I'll talk a little bit about the idea of really an informed democracy, because we do have the power to elect our own leaders here in the United States. That power comes with a great deal of responsibility, of course. And that responsibility is just simply to be well-informed. So I would say that I think the future is that Americans are, according to our research, very interested and hungry for information. And we hope that this research does inform people as they make decisions about their political choices.
I'd like to now entertain questions from the audience.
Thank you for coming to meet with us today. In one of your most recent answers, you mentioned that some of the respondents indicated that they really didn't want any help at all, or perhaps in help in the guise of technology. I'm interested, rather than with the broad word help, ways of demonstrating respect. From this, and certainly from some of your slides, it indicates that whether someone was considered a radical or considered mainstream, what came out as the most important priority was for the West, or specifically the United States, to demonstrate respect. So then did you give, did your researchers give participants an opportunity, either open-ended or by ranking, of specific ways that respect can be demonstrated?
That's a very good question. That is our follow-up research, and we're in the field right now with that exact question of how do, what does respect mean? How does one demonstrate respect? From just the data we've gathered thus far, what we find is that the issue of respect comes from two things. How our leaders or the representatives of the United States talk, and how they treat Muslims, or at least how they're perceived to treat Muslims. Here's a fundamental principle. If you admire someone and think that they stand for admirable values, and then that same person is perceived to treat you in a very less than admirable way, then that will be perceived as more of a type of prejudice or disrespect than if you simply didn't respect or admire that person and that person treats everybody badly. So it's kind of the difference between, a dictatorial government, which might do much of the same, and the reaction that people had when the United States, say, when the pictures of Abu Ghraib were released. So one U.S. diplomat told me that when she was in Egypt, and she was actually in Egypt when the whole thing broke, that people would tell her, "We expect this from our government, but not from you." And so it is actually because we've set the bar somewhat high that this whole issue of respect comes out, because of this disconnect between values and the way people are perceived to be treated.
When you come to the mic, could you introduce yourself? Certainly. Suggested was if you wanted to line up.
Solving the problem.
Patrick Murray, I teach here at Creighton. I wonder what it says about the formation of opinion in the U.S. about Arab and Muslim people, that in the wake of 9/11, it seemed to me there was really no public outcry against Saudi Arabia, even though most of the perpetrators were Saudi, bin Laden's Saudi. There was also seemed to be almost no reaction to one of the early consequences of the Iraq War, which was that Saudi Arabia sent the U.S. military forces out of Saudi Arabia, which seemed to be one of the leading demands of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, as I understand it. This seemed to be just not registered. So what does it say about the formation? I mean, you emphasize the differentials in how Muslims look at different Western countries, but what do these things say about the formation of opinion by people in the U.S. about Arabs and Muslims?
Well, I guess I'll just start by what we know about American opinion of different countries. And the most negatively viewed countries by Americans are North Korea, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, actually. And I think it is because of... and I do think Saudi Arabia is quite... I mean, I don't think this is even... It's not very easy It's not very easy to miss. Saudi Arabia is pretty demonized in the media. I don't think I've ever heard anything positive about Saudi Arabia in our media. And it is the most among the most negatively viewed countries in the world for Americans. Iran, North Korea, and Saudi Arabia. And I don't have a comment about how the Saudi government kicked out the troops with the invasion of Iraq. The issue, of course, was the justification for having troops there was the threat that Saddam Hussein presented the kingdom. And when he was gone, they figured, well, the reason for the troops is no longer needed. And so they got rid of the troops. So that's I guess, my response to why that happened. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by Dalia Mogahed, Senior Analyst and Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies in Washington, D.C., and co-author of Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think. Her appearance was sponsored by the United States Center for Citizen Diplomacy in partnership with the Gallup Organization and the World Affairs Council of America. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, May 28, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.